Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 4. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Over the last many months, off and on, as necessarily interrupted by other things, we have been working our way through the book of Ephesians on these Sunday mornings. Some of you may have noticed that I skipped this morning the previous section, which is the last part of Ephesians 5, which deals with Paul's admonitions to husbands and wives. The reason for that is that I preached on that passage several months ago. And so rather than doing it again now, if for some reason you want to hear about that particular passage, you're always welcome to get a tape from the church office, for all of our Sunday morning services are taped. But this morning we come to really the second part of Paul's encouragement and admonition and teaching about families. And here it's obviously directed toward children and fathers. Now it's clear that there is much here for mothers as well, and in fact it would be too narrow a reading of this to simply see Paul's word of father there as if he's not speaking to mothers at all. Rather, in fact, he's using father as much as he uses brothers in other places to mean brother and sister. Here, I think it's fair to say he's talking to both fathers and mothers. But I also think there's a lot here for couples without children. If you're newly married or you don't have children at all, or if you're single and are not married and do not have children, or if you're grandparents and your kids are up and grown, and in fact, they have children of their own now, there is something here for us all. Now, why do I say that? Well, I want you to think about just the what scholars might call the phenomena of the text. How does that sound as a sort of a highfalutin term? The phenomena of the text of the book of Ephesians is what? It is a letter written to a church. And in this letter, there are prescriptions and admonitions and directives given to what? To families, to wives and husbands, to children and parents. In the next section following this, to slave owners and the slaves, or we might say today, employers and employees. Why is it that these rather specific kinds of commands about Christian living are given in the context of a larger and broader letter that seems to have to do with broad, grand themes of the Christian life? Well, the answer is because broad, grand themes of Christian living must include admonitions to all of us who seek to live together in the family of the Lord's people. You see, Paul is in effect saying the church is an extended family. And just as the church is to know all the wonderful things that we learn in the earlier parts of the book of Ephesians about the greatness of God's love and His grace and His character as a sovereign, loving, eternal God and the great work He did for us in Christ, as the church is to learn of those things, so too is the church to learn of specific intramural, intra-family ways of living. In other words, all of us have a stake in families in the larger church family. And indeed, as part of this covenant family of the church, which the people that stood before you a few moments ago are pledging their allegiance to in the Lord this morning, we all have a stake. We all have something that is important to us in this church family. So even if you are single, you have a responsibility to the children of this church in the extended family. Even if you are grandparents, maybe especially if you're grandparents, the role modeling that you do for your own sons and daughters and for other people in this church who are now trying to raise their children is extremely important. If you're married and without children, then you are, as it were, storing up nuts for winter, and you're seeing ways in which, in the church family, other parents raise their children, and you are to watch and learn and contribute in your own way. So far from apologizing that a rather specific sermon is given to parents and children this morning, the Apostle Paul would have us celebrate the fact that we belong to each other in this church family. And because we do, we have mutual obligations and responsibilities to one another. This in itself, again, thinking about the phenomena of the text, is a radical departure from the culture in which Paul lived and wrote. In the Roman Empire, there was callous and cruel treatment at best of children. Children were no counts in ancient society. Unwanted babies were quickly and readily abandoned. Weak and deformed babies were simply killed. And even healthy children were often regarded as a nuisance by some because it inhibited sexual promiscuity on the part of parents and adults, or it complicated the obtaining of easy divorces. But Paul elevates the place of children, even by giving them attention which no one else in the ancient world would do. And in doing this, he really follows the Lord himself, who said, "Let the little children come to me, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven." So we have a very brief little section here of just four verses, but very important few verses that tell us a lot about not only our own nuclear families, but a lot about the quality of our church life together. How do we support one another? How do we create an atmosphere in the church, whether we're old, whether we're young, whether we have children or don't? How do we create an atmosphere where the right sort of things go on in Christian homes? That's Paul's concern here. And he breaks it down under two obvious categories: the duty of children and then the duty of parents. Let's just look at each for a few moments. The duty of children first. In the medieval church, it was very interesting that the command to obey one's parents was part of what was called natural justice. That is to say, it was not dependent upon special revelation, or what we call the Bible. In other words, it was built in, it was inherent into the fabric of every human being that they instinctively knew that a child was to obey one's parents. And this, therefore, was not confined to Christian thinking. Even in the ancient world, maybe especially in the ancient world, Roman pagan moralists would talk about the need for children to obey their parents. Certainly in Eastern cultures, which had no contact with Christianity, and still their contact is quite limited, the notion of children obeying parents is quite a strong one. So Paul, in fact, in his famous list in Romans 1, where he lists all of those awful things that human beings apart from God can do, one of them is that we become disobedient to our parents. And what he's trying to say there is that being disobedient to our parents is one of the signs of a culture that is coming unraveled. Now, a practical question that maybe made more sense at the earlier service when we had more of the younger people. In fact, we honored the high school seniors at the earlier service, and so there were several rows of them over here earlier this morning, and they became a wonderful foil for some of my remarks as I could address remarks directly to them. But nevertheless, I think a question is here for us all, a practical question. Who are the children who are to obey their parents? Infants, toddlers, youngsters, teenagers, unmarried and those living at home, even if they're older? In most Western countries, the age 18 becomes a kind of demarcation point. In other words, it's a key hinge time when a child is no longer considered a child in terms of the law. He's allowed to vote. He's free to marry without his parents' consent. The opposite extreme was in the Roman Empire, where a child would never be free of the necessity of being bound to the legal authority of his parents. The power of the Roman father extended over a child's whole life, as long as the father lived. A Roman son, in fact, never came of age. And you see this, as I've already indicated, in some ancient, and particularly Oriental cultures today. Simply put, I would suggest to you that Christians should accept the conventions of their own culture insofar as that culture does not violate the express standards of God's law. So if 18 is roughly the age in which a child becomes legally responsible in our culture, then that would be the way in which we are to understand this command, with one very important caveat. It's this. Financial responsibility for a child certainly should carry with it clear weight of authority. So a child, even, or a young person who is older than 18, but who lives, as we would say in our culture today, under his or her parents' roof, should see himself or herself as still obliged to obey his or her parents. The financial ties, in other words, are quite important. They connote significant attachments. That's why in marriage, we often say when a young couple marries, they leave and cleave. That is, they leave their parents, respectively, and they cleave to one another, forming a new family unit. And in my counsel to young people getting married, I always say that leaving includes the notion of financially leaving. And if a young couple getting married is still dependent on his or her parents, I would suggest to you there's room for some caution and concern there. Leaving means a financial leaving, and when a child is grown, either married or not, who moves out from under his parents' roof, is on his own financially, then I think a change takes place in this obligation to obey one's parents. Let me see if I can help you further with this by suggesting what Paul says. The command to obey one's parents is within the umbrella, under the umbrella of a larger command, and that is to honor one's parents. In fact, I would suggest to you that to obey one's parents is one aspect of what it means to honor them. To honor comes from the Hebrew notion of weightiness. It's closely associated with the Hebrew word for glory. Glory literally means in the Old Testament weight. The idea that if something has glory, it has weight, heaviness. It's there. So, for example, in Psalm 119, it says, the heavens are telling of the glory or honor of God. In other words, all of the stars proclaim the weightiness of God. Isaiah 6 says, the whole earth is full of God's glory or honor. And Proverbs 3 says, honor the Lord from your wealth. So it's clear that the honor that we give to God is to be done in practical and concrete terms, even from our material goods. So the notion of honoring our parents is the idea of them having weight in our lives. And I believe that all of Scripture would suggest to us that that kind of honoring of our parents never ends. As long as they are alive, and even after they are dead, we are to honor their memory. So we honor our parents, which I think if you break it down means this. We reverence them, and we are grateful to them. And third, when we are under their roof, we obey them. And only this third part of what it means to honor ceases when we are no longer under their roof. So, without further looking at the notion of honoring, let's zero in on the idea of obedience. What does that mean? Here's a definition for you. To obey means to conform your outward actions to your parents' expressed will. To conform your outward actions to your parents' expressed will. I would suggest to you that we are not responsible for what our parents don't express. We are responsible for what they say. Now, young people, as we all know, will think of this as a burden. The idea that I must obey my parents seems to be such a heavy weight. And indeed, we see that young people are always looking for ways out of it. In fact, I was reminded after the last service of the kids of our own community that are constantly playing their parents off of their friends by saying to their parents, "Well, so-and-so does it." How many of you parents have heard that in your day? "So-and-so goes to this kind of movie. So-and-so is going to that party. So-and-so is doing this or that." And the parents feel constrained by all kinds of social pressures which may have nothing to do with their direct responsibility as parents. Let me give you a contrary example that I will always remember because it speaks volumes to this issue. Several years ago, a young woman of first year of college age, freshman in college, came and asked for an appointment. And when we sat down to talk, she handed me a piece of paper. And at the top of it, it said, "Rules for Dating." And underneath it had her father's name, or at least a man's name that I assumed to be her father. I said, "Uh-oh." And immediately in my mind, I thought, what this young lady is going to ask me is, what in the world is she supposed to do with this terrible list? And how can she sort of appease her father, but basically remove herself from the obligations of this list? Well, what she said to me as I finished reading it and gulped and said, "How can I help you?" She said, "I would like your help, Skip, in knowing how to keep my father's word." And after I picked myself up off the floor and sat back down on the couch, I said, "You mean you want to do what your dad says here?" And she says, "Oh, yes. That's why I'm here. I want to know how to do it." One of the things I said in the last hour to the young people was whether they realized that God has given them parents. That may sound very simple. And for any of us who've walked with the Lord for any length of time, we do recognize that. But actively, I don't think many young people today really move on that assumption. In other words, we need to encourage the young people in our own church to understand that God is sovereign in giving them the parents that they have. And God has provided parents to be a protection, an umbrella of protection. And this young lady got that idea. And she saw that the rules that her father had given her about the conduct of her social life were not rules which were onerous or burdensome, but they were rules intended to liberate her. The list included things like, be in at a certain time. Don't go to certain places. Don't do certain things. They were rather specific. Most college freshmen rejoice at the fact that they're finally liberated from such rules. But she saw her father's protection. How many of you have heard the term loco parentis? I'm sure many of you have. It's a Latin term. It basically means parents in locale. It often is used in reference to colleges or universities, where children or young people away from their homes are under the parental authority, a derived parental authority of the administration of that university or college. Sadly, it is an authority that college administrators have simply renounced within the last generation. 25 years ago, when I was a freshman in college, I guess it was a little more than 25 years ago, but we had what were called parietal hours. Do you know what they are? They're the hours in which a young lady could visit a gentleman in his room at college. Our parietal hours were 5 to 7 on weekday evenings, and three times a semester we had what were called extended parietal hours on a Friday or Saturday night, and that meant that a young lady could be in our rooms with the door open until 11 p.m. That slip of the tongue that I almost made, though, is understandable, because 4 years later, when I graduated, 4 years later, the administrators of my university had totally revoked their God-given responsibility to be loco parentis, and there were no parietal hours. None. And indeed, I think it's that way in most colleges and universities in our country today. In other words, men and women can be in each other's rooms at any time of day or night, door open or closed. I urged young people, as I will now again, not to see your parents' authority as a burden, but instead to see it as the wings by which you fly. There's a big difference. A bird doesn't complain about the weight of his wings. A bird says, "These wings let me fly." And that's really what the authority of a parent is supposed to be. Now, let me move on, if I could, quickly, and just say a couple of things to parents. Parents are not to exasperate their children, but instead to bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. If children are to obey parents, it's clear that parents have authority. But the interesting thing about the way the Apostle Paul talks about this authority here is not in terms of its exercise, but in terms of its restraint. In other words, he's saying, parents, I assume you have authority, but now I'm calling upon you to restrain yourself in your use of it. And the picture of fathers as self-controlled and gentle and patient is in stark contrast to the times in which Paul wrote, as I've already indicated to you. The entry for father in the Oxford Classical Dictionary says this: at the head of the Roman family was the father who exercised absolute authority over all members of the family. The autocratic character of the father meant he not only had the right to punish, but to even take the life of his children at will. He could sell his children as slaves. He could put chains about them and make them work in the fields. He was, in fact, the law. He took the law into his own hands because he was the law. Now, I want you to see what an enormous revolution in the world the Christian revolution brought. Because no longer, despite what some dads might say in a moment of, prideful self-advancement, when they might say, "I'm the law around here," it's not true. They're not. The law around here is God's law. And God's law is the law by which fathers themselves are to live. They themselves are under God's law, and therefore the law they mediate to their children is God's law and not their own. Which means that a father's authority is within the bounds that are defined by God's word. We find all this about the ancient world so shocking. And yet what should be more startling to us is the dramatic and deep effect that Christ has had on Western civilization in just this regard. Human fathers are to care for their families after the fashion that God the Father cares for his family. Parents, Paul says, are not to exasperate their children. Other translations put this: they're not to provoke their children to anger, or you're not to goad your children to resentment, is the way the New English Bible puts it. Paul is getting at the misuse of authority, which exasperates a child, which causes resentment, which provokes them to be angry people. as Paul puts it elsewhere in Colossians chapter 3, the arbitrary or unkind use of discipline becomes a discouragement to a child, a disheartening effect upon a child. Parents, in other words, must recognize the unique life and personality of each of their own children. And they are not to squash that unique life or personality with arbitrary demands. Rather, their discipline and instruction of their children is to grow out of God's commands, so that we as parents accurately reflect to our own kids God's truth and God's standards, God's discipline and instruction, and not simply our own. Let me give you a rather extreme example of how parents can squash the individuality of a child by telling you something that I've learned since I moved to Texas. Over 2 years ago now, when I first moved here, I wanted to learn more about our wonderful state, our new home. And so I went to a lifelong Texan and I said, "How can I learn about Texas?" And he said, "Learn about Texas through its myths," by which he meant the great stories that have shaped the culture of Texas. And I said, "Like what?" And he said, "Well, the Alamo would be one." So we went and visited the Alamo and learned a lot about Texas. The other one he suggested, interestingly enough, was the book and the movie Giant, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. I'm wondering how many of you have actually read the wonderful book by Edna Ferber called Giant, her magnificent novel about the story of a Texan named Jordan Benedict. He was the owner of a 2.5 million acre cattle ranch. And in the story, he is furious because his 3-year-old son Jordy does not like horses. And when he sets his son on a horse in order to teach him to ride, his son is very unhappy about it. And so Mr. Benedict says to his son, "I rode before I could walk." And his wife, Leslie, says, "All right, that was very cute, but that was you. This is another person. Maybe he doesn't like horses." And his father responds, "He's a Benedict, and I'm going to make a horseman out of him if I have to tie him to it." And his wife says, "You've been playing God so long, you think you run the world." "I run the part of it that's mine, he said. He is not yours," his wife answered. "He's yours and mine. And he's not even ours. He's himself." The great challenge for all of us as parents, isn't it, is how to make our children themselves. How to release, as it were, to use that kind of imagery, the people they are becoming under God's sovereign hand and leadership. Paul suggests that the way we do that is with the right balance of discipline and instruction. Now, I've just spent a whole semester with the men of the church trying to talk about what discipline and instruction means, so there's no way we can go into a detailed account of it now. I would simply suggest this to you. Discipline or correction are the tracks that are laid down for the train of our children's personality to run. Instruction is the engine that powers the train of their lives along those tracks. Parents must be very careful lest their discipline and instruction go in opposite directions. Saying one thing to our children, but actually doing another ourselves. Giving our children mixed messages, the chief one of which I would suggest to you that I know currently is drink, but don't drive. That's a mixed message. Why? The law says, don't drink at all. But we say, go ahead and drink, just don't hurt yourself. Go ahead and drink, but just don't hurt someone else. In other words, we give a mixed message by what we say or don't say, how we correct or don't correct. I think that what we must do as parents is train up our children in such a way that they learn to think for themselves. Isn't that what we're trying to do? Isn't that what some of you who have raised children tried to do? Is to train up your children so they could think and act before God for themselves. The word train up comes from the Hebrew notion of palate. It actually refers to the roof of the mouth. And the notion there is that a Hebrew midwife or mother, upon the birth of a child, would take dates and crush them against the roof of the baby's mouth in order to stimulate the sucking reflex so that the child could take nourishment. What is your objective as a parent? As a grandparent? As a Sunday school teacher? As a role model to young people? I would suggest that the grand objective for all of us is to teach our children how to take nourishment from the Lord. To stimulate the desire they have to take from the Lord's nurture. So that they themselves come to depend upon the Lord and not on us. That's a deep challenge. That challenge mitigates against the notion of obey me or else. It goes far deeper than that, doesn't it? It has to do with the way I live. It has to do with the three most significant ways in which a parent corrects and instructs his child. Example, example, and example. It has to do with the way we live our own lives deep in our own hearts. What's most important to us? For whatever is most important to us, our kids will know it. Our grandchildren will know it. They'll sense it. So the call of Paul to be the kind of parents we should be is really a call to a kind of heart-searching analysis of our own deepest values. What do I want for them? What do I want for myself? What's really important?